Iraq's weapons of mass destruction are controlled by a murderous tyrant who has already used chemical weapons to kill thousands of people. This same tyrant has tried to dominate the Middle East, has invaded and brutally occupied a small neighbor, has struck other nations without warning, and holds an unrelenting hostility toward the United States. By its past and present actions, by its technological capabilities, by the merciless nature of its regime, Iraq is unique. As a former chief weapons inspector of the UN has said, the fundamental problem with Iraq remains the nature of the regime itself. Saddam Hussein is a homicidal dictator who is addicted to weapons of mass destruction. Some ask how urgent this danger is to America and the world. The danger is already significant, and it only grows worse with time. If we know Saddam Hussein has dangerous weapons today, and we do, does it make any sense for the world to wait to confront him as he grows even stronger and develops even more dangerous weapons? In 1995, after several years of deceit by the Iraqi regime, the head of Iraq's military industries defected. It was then that the regime was forced to admit that it had produced more than 30,000 liters of anthrax and other deadly biological agents. The inspectors, however, concluded that Iraq had likely produced 2 to 4 times that amount. This is a massive stockpile of biological weapons that has never been accounted for and is capable of killing millions. We know that the regime has produced thousands of tons of chemical agents, including mustard gas, sarin nerve gas, VX nerve gas. Saddam Hussein also has experience in using chemical weapons. He's ordered chemical attacks on Iran and on more than 40 villages in his own country. These actions killed or injured at least 20,000 people, more than 6 times the number of people who died in the attacks of September the 11th. And surveillance photos reveal that the regime is rebuilding facilities that it had used to produce chemical and biological weapons. Every chemical and biological weapon that Iraq has or makes is a direct violation of the truce that ended the Persian Gulf War in 1991. Yet Saddam Hussein has chosen to build and keep these weapons despite international sanctions, UN demands, and isolation from the civilized world. Iraq possesses ballistic missiles with a likely range of hundreds of miles, far enough to strike Saudi Arabia, Israel, Turkey, and other nations in a region where more than 135,000 American civilians and service members live and work. We've also discovered through intelligence that Iraq has a growing fleet of manned and unmanned aerial vehicles that could be used to disperse chemical or biological weapons across broad areas. We're concerned that Iraq is exploring ways of using these UAVs for missions targeting the United States. And of course, sophisticated delivery systems aren't required for a chemical or biological attack. All that might be required are a small container and one terrorist or Iraqi intelligence operative to deliver it. And that is the source of our urgent concern about Saddam Hussein's links to international terrorist groups. Over the years, Iraq has provided safe haven to terrorists such as Abu Nidal, whose terror organization carried out more than 90 terrorist attacks in 20 countries that killed or injured nearly 900 people, including 12 Americans. Iraq has also provided safe haven to Abu Abbas, who was responsible for seizing the Achille Lauro and killing an American passenger. And we know that Iraq is continuing to finance terror. and gives assistance to groups that use terrorism to undermine Middle East peace. We know that Iraq and the Al-Qaeda terrorist network share a common enemy, the United States of America. We know that Iraq and Al-Qaeda have had high-level contacts that go back a decade. Some Al-Qaeda leaders who fled Afghanistan went to Iraq. These include one very senior Al-Qaeda leader who received medical treatment in Baghdad this year and who has been associated with planning for chemical and biological attacks. We've learned that Iraq has trained Al-Qaeda members in bomb making, in poisons, and deadly gases. And we know that after September the 11th, Saddam Hussein's regime gleefully celebrated the terrorist attacks on America. Iraq could decide on any given day to provide a biological or chemical weapon to a terrorist group or individual terrorists. Alliance with terrorists could allow the Iraqi regime to attack America without leaving any fingerprints. Some have argued that confronting the threat from Iraq could detract from the war against terror. To the contrary, confronting the threat posed by Iraq is crucial to winning the war on terror. When I spoke to Congress more than a year ago, I said that those who harbor terrorists are as guilty as the terrorists themselves. Saddam Hussein is harboring terrorists and the instruments of terror, the instruments of mass death and destruction, and he cannot be trusted. The risk is simply too great that he will use them or provide them to a terror network. Terror cells and outlaw regimes building weapons of mass destruction are different faces of the same evil. Our security requires that we confront both, and the United States military is capable of confronting both. Many people have asked how close Saddam Hussein is to developing a nuclear weapon. Well, we don't know exactly, and that's the problem. Before the Gulf War, the best intelligence indicated that Iraq was 8 to 10 years away from developing a nuclear weapon. After the war, international inspectors learned that the regime had been much closer. The regime in Iraq would likely have possessed a nuclear weapon no later than 1993. The inspectors discovered that Iraq had an advanced nuclear weapons development program, had a design for a workable nuclear weapon, and was pursuing several different methods of enriching uranium for a bomb. Before being barred from Iraq in 1998, the International Atomic Energy Agency dismantled extensive nuclear weapons-related facilities, including 3 uranium enrichment sites. That same year, information from a high-ranking Iraqi nuclear engineer who had defected revealed that despite his public promises, Saddam Hussein had ordered his nuclear program to continue. The evidence indicates that Iraq is reconstituting its nuclear weapons program. Saddam Hussein has held numerous meetings with Iraqi nuclear scientists, a group he calls his nuclear mujahideen, his nuclear holy warriors. Satellite photographs reveal that Iraq is rebuilding facilities at sites that have been part of its nuclear program in the past. Iraq has attempted to purchase high-strength aluminum tubes and other equipment needed for gas centrifuges, which are used to enrich uranium for nuclear weapons. If the Iraqi regime is able to produce, buy, or steal an amount of highly enriched uranium a little larger than a single softball, it could have a nuclear weapon in less than a year. And if we allow that to happen, a terrible line would be crossed. Saddam Hussein would be in a position to blackmail anyone who opposes his aggression. He would be in a position to dominate the Middle East. He would be in a position to threaten America. And Saddam Hussein would be in a position to pass nuclear technology terrorists. Some citizens wonder, after 11 years of living with this problem, why do we need to confront it now? And there's a reason. We have experienced the horror of September the 11th. We have seen that those who hate America are willing to crash airplanes into buildings full of innocent people. Our enemies would be no less willing. In fact, they would be eager to use biological or chemical or a nuclear weapon. Knowing these realities, America must not ignore the threat gathering against us. Facing clear evidence of peril, we cannot wait for the final proof, the smoking gun, that could come in the form of a mushroom cloud. As President Kennedy said in October of 1962, neither the United States of America nor the world community of nations can tolerate deliberate deception and offensive threats on the part of any nation, large or small. We no longer live in a world, he said, where only the actual firing of weapons represents a sufficient challenge to a nation's security to constitute maximum peril. Understanding the threats of our time, knowing the designs and deceptions of the Iraqi regime, we have every reason to assume the worst, and we have an urgent duty to prevent the worst from occurring. Some believe we can address this danger by simply resuming the old approach to inspections and applying diplomatic and economic pressure. Yet this is precisely what the world has tried to do since 1991. The UN inspections program was met with systematic deception. The Iraqi regime bugged hotel rooms and offices of inspectors to find where they were going next. They forged documents, destroyed evidence, and developed mobile weapons facilities to keep a step ahead of inspectors. 8 so-called presidential palaces were declared off limits to unfettered inspections. These sites actually encompass 12 square miles with hundreds of structures, both above and below the ground, where sensitive materials could be hidden. The world has also tried economic sanctions and watched Iraq use billions of dollars in illegal oil revenues to fund more weapons purchases rather than providing for the needs of the Iraqi people. The world has tried limited military strikes to destroy Iraq's weapons of mass destruction capabilities, only to see them openly rebuilt, while the regime again denies they even exist. The world has tried no-fly zones to keep Saddam from terrorizing his own people. And in the last year alone, the Iraqi military has fired upon American and British pilots more than 750 times. After 11 years during which we have tried containment, sanctions, inspections, even selected military action, the end result is that Saddam Hussein still has chemical and biological weapons and is increasing his capabilities to make more. And he is moving ever closer to developing a nuclear weapon. Clearly, to actually work, any new inspections, sanctions, or enforcement mechanisms will have to be very different. America wants the UN to be an effective organization that helps keep the peace. And that is why we are urging the Security Council to adopt a new resolution setting out tough, immediate requirements. Among those requirements, the Iraqi regime must reveal and destroy, under UN supervision, all existing weapons of mass destruction. To ensure that we learn the truth, the regime must allow witnesses to its illegal activities to be interviewed outside the country. And these witnesses must be free to bring their families with them, so they are all beyond the reach of Saddam Hussein's terror and murder. And inspectors must have access to any site at any time without preclearance, without delay, without exceptions. The time for denying to support personnel including an American pilot whose fate is still unknown. By taking these steps, and by only taking these steps, the Iraqi regime has an opportunity to avoid conflict. These steps would also change the nature of the Iraqi regime itself. America hopes the regime will make that choice. Unfortunately, at least so far, we have little reason to expect it. And that's why two administrations, mine and President Clinton's, have stated that regime change in Iraq is the only certain means of removing a great danger to our nation. I hope this will not require military action, but it may. And military conflict could be difficult. An Iraqi regime faced with its own demise may attempt cruel and desperate measures. If Saddam Hussein orders such measures, his generals would be well advised to refuse those orders. If they do not refuse, they must understand that all war criminals will be pursued and punished. If we have to act, we will take every precaution that is possible. We will plan carefully. We will act with the full power of the United States military. We will act with allies at our side, and we will prevail. There is no easy or risk-free course of action. Some have argued we should wait, and that's an option. In my view, it's the riskiest of all options, because the longer we wait, the stronger and bolder Saddam Hussein will become. We could wait and hope that Saddam does not give weapons to terrorists or develop a nuclear weapon to blackmail the world. But I'm convinced that is a hope against all evidence. As Americans, we want peace. We work and sacrifice for peace. But there can be no peace if our security depends on the will and whims of a ruthless and aggressive dictator. I'm not willing to stake one American life on trusting Saddam Hussein. Failure to act would embolden other tyrants, allow terrorists access to new weapons and new resources, and make blackmail a permanent feature of world events. The United Nations would betray the purpose of its founding and prove irrelevant to the problems of our time. And through its inaction, the United States would resign itself to a future of fear. That is not the America I know. That is not the America I serve. We refuse to live in fear. This nation, in World War and in Cold War, has never permitted the brutal and lawless to set history's course. Now, as before, we will secure our nation, protect our freedom, and help others to find freedom of their own. Some worry that a change of leadership in Iraq could create instability and make the situation worse. The situation could hardly get worse for world security and for the people of Iraq. The lives of Iraqi citizens would improve dramatically if Saddam Hussein were no longer in power, just as the lives of Afghanistan's citizens improved after the Taliban. The dictator of Iraq is a student of Stalin, using murder as a tool of terror and control within his own cabinet, within his own army, and even within his own family. On Saddam Hussein's orders, opponents have been decapitated. Wives and mothers of political opponents have been systematically raped as a method of intimidation. And political prisoners have been forced to watch their own children being tortured. America believes that all people are entitled to hope and human rights, to the non-negotiable demands of human dignity. People everywhere prefer freedom to slavery, prosperity to squalor, self-government to the rule of terror and torture. America is a friend to the people of Iraq. Our demands are directed only at the regime that enslaves them and threatens us. When these demands are met, the first and greatest benefit will come to Iraqi men, women, and children. The oppression of Kurds, Assyrians, Turkomans, Shia, Sunnis, and others will be lifted. The long captivity of Iraq will end, and an era of new hope will begin. Iraq is a land rich in culture, resources, and talent. Freed from the weight of oppression, Iraq's people will be able to share in the progress and prosperity of our time. If military action is necessary, the United States and our allies will help the Iraqi people rebuild their economy and create the institutions of liberty in a unified Iraq at peace with its neighbors. Later this week, the United States Congress will vote on this matter. I have asked Congress to authorize the use of America's military if it proves necessary to enforce UN Security Council demands. Approving this resolution does not mean that military action is imminent or unavoidable. The resolution will tell the United Nations and all nations that America speaks with one voice and is determined to make the demands of the civilized world mean something. Congress will also be sending a message to the dictator in Iraq that his only choice is full compliance, and the time remaining for that choice is limited. Members of Congress are nearing an historic vote. I'm confident they will fully consider the facts and their duties. The attacks of September the 11th showed our country that vast oceans no longer protect us from danger. Before that tragic date, we had only hints of Al-Qaeda's plans and designs. Today in Iraq, we see a threat whose outlines are far more clearly defined and whose consequences could be far more deadly. Saddam Hussein's actions have put us on notice. And there is no refuge from our responsibilities. We did not ask for this present challenge, but we accept it. Like other generations of Americans, we will meet the responsibility of defending human liberty against violence and aggression. By our resolve, we will give strength to others. By our courage, we will give hope to others. And by our actions, we will secure the peace and lead the world to a better day. May God bless America.
That was President Bush speaking tonight from Cincinnati, Ohio, before several hundred invited guests at the Cincinnati Museum Center, a historic railway station where American soldiers boarded trains to fight in World War II. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and you're listening to On Point. To discuss the president's speech, I'll be joined tonight by Richard Perle, resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute and supporter of military action against Iraq, by Congresswoman Marcy Kaptur, Democrat from Ohio and vocal critic of the administration's Iraq policy, Stephen Walt, professor of international relations at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, and by you. Did the president convince you that the threat from Saddam Hussein is real and imminent? Is it time to be prepared for war? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me tonight in the studio is Stephen Walt, professor of international affairs at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Good evening and welcome, Stephen Walt.
Nice to be here.
Good to have you. You hear the president putting out, once again, his forceful recitation of the crimes of Saddam Hussein against humanity, against human decency. It is, once again, an imposing list, guaranteed to send shivers down anyone's back. Can Congress possibly resist an overwhelming vote of support for that list of terrifying particulars?
No, but there's no sign that Congress was going to. I mean, I think most of the experts looking at this understood that the president was going to get a fair degree of support out of Congress. It was, I think, actually a reasonably effective speech from a political point of view, not necessarily the most persuasive speech in terms of actual logic or evidence, but it shows you the real power of the presidency to mobilize people, to listen to the counterarguments that have started to be voiced over the last few weeks, and then to try and deal with each one of them point by point. I think the salient thing in the speech was, first of all, how he was attempting to, as often as possible, link Saddam Hussein to international terrorism, understanding that in the wake of September 11th, that has a lot of political impact. It was really almost a mantra that kept coming up. Second, he went to great lengths to try and indicate that Saddam Hussein really was a unique threat, that he was quite different than other dictators, even other countries that have had weapons of mass destruction. There, I don't think he presented a very powerful case. You could point, for example, he said at one point that that Saddam Hussein was a student of Stalin. It's mm-hmm. worth remembering that Stalin's atrocities made Saddam Hussein's look pale by comparison, and Saddam Hussein had nuclear weapons, and we didn't go to war against him. So I'm not sure how persuasive he was on that front. And finally, he tried to convey the sense of urgency, that we really couldn't wait on this one at all. And there, I think, you know, those who were already persuaded are likely to see more support there. And those who were unconvinced before the speech probably will not have their minds changed.
So you're great as a political speech, effective as a geopolitical strategy formula.
Not particularly convincing. For example, there was a recitation on several occasions that Saddam Hussein would dominate the Middle East if we didn't deal with the regime now. I think there's no evidence to suggest that. Iraqi military power is a pale shadow of what it used to be. Israel has 100 to 200 nuclear weapons of its own, could easily deter an Iraqi attack. He wasn't persuasive, it seems to me, on conveying that there was an immediate threat there. He was certainly good at conveying that Saddam Hussein is a very bad man.
Stephen Walt, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation Richard Perle. He's a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, former Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Reagan administration, and a leading thinker in Washington in support of regime change in Iraq. Good evening and welcome, Richard Perle.
Good evening to you.
Richard Perle, your assessment of the speech in political terms, in geopolitical terms.
Well, I thought it was a very good speech. This is a president who, in the course of the campaign, less than 2 years ago, was widely criticized for his, I never thought it, but his failure at the podium to be compelling. And tonight he was compelling. I don't think there's any doubt about that. This was not a presentation of new material. We've heard much of this before, but he brought it all together in a very crisp 30 minutes.
Let me ask you about the point that Stephen Walt raises here. He says that the premise that Saddam Hussein is an imminent threat to his own region, he doesn't buy. Your view, Richard Perle?
Well, I think we're now at a stage where Saddam Hussein has the potential to dominate the region simply by continuing to defy and defeat the United Nations and defy and scorn the United States. The fact that he can do that and get away with it makes him a larger-than-life figure in the region. And while his military capability is limited in relation to that of the United States, it is very powerful indeed in relation to his neighbors, two of whom he's already invaded once and could do again.
Richard Perle, I want to put to you a shading I thought I might have heard tonight. In recent days, the public impression has been that President Bush has been in some kind of flux about exactly what's required. At one point, he listed everything required of Iraq to meet the demands of the United States, the international community. And then he said these steps will change the nature of the regime itself. Is there an implication here that Saddam Hussein's removal might not be necessary if enough of the requirements that President Bush is laying down tonight were met? Is it possible that Saddam Hussein might stay? Is that what's being suggested here?
I don't think so. I think what he's saying is that if the regime were to adopt a set of policies radically different from the ones that they have been clinging to, that we could then look at this as a different regime. He's saying, in short, if the leopard changes its spots, we will regard it as a different leopard. That isn't going to happen.
So it's a possibility put out, but not something that's realistically going to happen, in your view. And what about the question?
Because, look, among other things, he was calling on Saddam immediately to give up his weapons of mass destruction. Because he denies that he has any, it would be very difficult for him now to come forward and say, well, here they are.
Are you confident that Congress will pass the resolution, and is the amended resolution sufficient for the task, in your view?
I think the resolution that he will get will be adequate. It won't be a blank check, but that's all right. He doesn't need a blank check. It will be sufficient authority so that if, in his judgment, there is no other way to bring about the disarmament of Iraq, he will have all the authority he needs to use American military.
And finally, Richard Perle, the president said tonight that approving the resolution does not mean that military action is imminent or unavoidable. Assuming the resolution is passed, do you think war is not unavoidable?
Well, when it comes to war, it isn't over until it begins, and no one wants to embark upon a war, and therefore everything is done to try to avert it at the last minute, including behavior that one wouldn't have expected before the last minute. So I don't think anyone can confidently predict where this will all wind up.
Richard Perle, thanks for joining us tonight.
All the best.
Richard Perle is resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Stephen Walt, you hear there one of the thought leaders in the administration pushing war with Iraq and absolute confidence that the road is clear, it's time to go forward.
Well, one thing we should all recognize is there's always uncertainty as you're contemplating military force. The advocates of war believe that everything is going to fall in their favor, that they can go to war, that they'll get international support, that the regime will collapse quickly, that none of the alleged arsenal of weapons of mass destruction are going to be used, and then peace will break out within Iraq. It won't cause regional instability, and in fact, it'll enhance the war on terror. That's may be true. It's possible that all those good things will happen. But it is, I think, just as likely, probably more likely, that some of those things will not go as well as the administration believes. And in fact, this is not going to turn out to be the best approach to dealing with what is admittedly a serious problem.
Stephen Walt, we have to take a short break. We're talking tonight about the president's speech. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We will be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the president's speech given this evening in a railroad terminal converted to a museum in Cincinnati, Ohio. You could hear the president's voice echoing through that terminal like last call for a train that was pulling out of the station. With me tonight in studio is Stephen Walt, professor of international affairs at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Before we go back to our conversation, let's listen to a brief clip of President Bush describing why the world needs to act soon in Iraq.
There is no easy or risk-free course of action. Some have argued we should wait, and that's an option. In my view, it's the riskiest of all options, because the longer we wait, the stronger and bolder Saddam Hussein will become. We could wait and hope that Saddam does not give weapons to terrorists or develop a nuclear weapon to blackmail the world. But I'm convinced that is a hope against all evidence.
President Bush tonight in Cincinnati. Stephen Walt, How do you respond to that sense of here's a threat, it's growing day by day, month by month. If it's not addressed now, it'll have to be addressed later. It will only be worse. If we take the president's words at face value, this is the kind of statement that would seem to lead anybody to stand up and say, yes, let's go.
The speech was very effective in conveying a real sense of danger. A threat. This is a crazy guy who's going to do lots of bad things to us.
But isn't he a threat?
No.
His weapons programs a threat?
There are 9 countries that have nuclear weapons around the world, and we don't consider all of them an imminent danger. Perhaps the most unconvincing part is this idea that if he ever got weapons of mass destruction, he could blackmail the world. You can't blackmail someone with a threat that you yourself cannot implement. He could not use any of those weapons of mass destruction without facing massive American retaliation or retaliation from other countries such as Israel.
But the president said tonight the potential link with terrorists leaves a no fingerprint scenario where somebody else delivers the chemical, the biological, the nuclear.
It's not convincing to me that someone who has worked as hard as he has to get a hold of a weapon of mass destruction would then hand it off to someone else. Moreover, he could never be confident that we could not trace it back to him. There's no way of guaranteeing that there wouldn't be fingerprints, and you would know that if a weapon of mass destruction were ever delivered on the United States, we would be taking no prisoners in going after whoever we thought might be responsible. If you have weapons of mass destruction, you want to retain very tight control over them. You don't want to hand them off to anybody else. I find that a effective scenario for scaring people, but it's not a very realistic danger.
It's an alternate view. Tamara's on the line. Hi, Tamara. You're on the air.
Hi. I would like to say that before World War II, only Churchill was saying that Hitler has to be taken care of. But Europeans were too tired after World War I and didn't want to fight for whatever reason. They still had to fight, but it would be much easier if they listened to Churchill before. So I'm not saying that it's going to be easy, but it's probably necessary. And I have a feeling that administration knows something about Saddam Hussein that they cannot reveal without endangering those sources. And it doesn't...
Tomorrow, we've got it. Let me put it to Stephen Walt, and thank you for your call. Stephen Walt, here it is. We hear in the speech the parallels to Stalin throughout, even from George Bush Sr. There was the comparison with Hitler, the idea that if we don't go in, we are just preparing the table for an awful future. What about this, the Hitler comparison, the Germany before World War II? Are these reasonable comparisons?
I don't think they're as evocative as the caller suggested. Germany under Adolf Hitler was a great power whose power grew steadily throughout the 1930s and who had ambitions of dominating all of Europe and the military power to do that. Saddam Hussein's power has done nothing but shrink over the past 10 years. His military is a shadow of what it once was. He has, I think, quite limited ambitions in the Middle East. It's also worth remembering that this is a regime that we have supported at various points in the past. We supported them in their war against Iran in the 1980s, and we gave them, if not a green light, at least a yellow light vis-a-vis Kuwait in 1990, not warning them away from it. So it's not an irrational regime. It's a regime that lives in a bad neighborhood, has done very many bad things, but is quite different than Nazi Germany.
Stephen Walt, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation Congresswoman Marcy Kaptur, a Democrat from Ohio. She's just rushed off the House floor to join us, and we're awfully happy to have you. Marcy Kaptur, good evening and welcome.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
You heard the president speaking tonight in your home state to fairly thunderous applause when he stepped to the podium. You know the projections that the Congress will pass the authorization for military action in Iraq overwhelmingly, yet you're opposing it. Why?
Because I don't think that the president talks about why he made the statement Iraq hates America most of all. Why would that be? What are the conditions that are breeding this hatred in that part of the world, whether it be inside of Iraq or in the other regimes, all of them undemocratic, in that part of the world? He doesn't really talk about the unresolved Israeli-Palestinian issue, which had its currency initially in this country in 1968 with the assassination of Robert Kennedy, when for the first time we got the first shot of across the bow of the beginning of real terrorism in our country, escalating through 9/11 last year. He doesn't deal with the oil regimes that our dollars have helped to create over the past 50 years. We are yielding some of the seeds that we have planted. He tries to demonize one person and one regime. There are many bad regimes over there.
Marcy Kaptur, you heard the president tonight. You know how his words resonate in your own district.
Yes.
Is it for you at this point political trouble that you've stood up and staked your position in opposition to war in Iraq? Is this a viable political path right now?
It is certainly a viable path. I am representing the vast majority of people in my district. I think they are very thoughtful people. We are a very diverse district, many people tracing their roots to that part of the world. I think that we have the highest number of veterans per square foot of any congressional district in America, and I don't have a big army base out there. And so I think our people really understand the cost of war, but also believe that America should not be isolated by this regime. We should be isolating that regime. We shouldn't be going it alone or being big brother in every country whose regime we don't like, but indeed we should be working to get the inspections that the president desires. We all want that. We need to keep our focus on the war on terrorism and not lose sight of Al-Qaeda and the other problems that we have. But fundamentally, what we need to do is solve the Israeli-Palestinian question and unhook ourselves from dependence on imported petroleum from that region. Those are the fundamental issues that are helping to create the hatred that the president talks about. He doesn't talk about the context of the problem. He only singles out one or two individuals and some of the weaponry that they might have acquired, by the way, some of it through the United States of America.
Congresswoman Kaptur, if that is indeed the view of constituents in your district, why do opinion polls show the American public generally in favor of this war, and why is Congress expected to vote overwhelmingly in favor of the authorization?
I think because of the way the question is asked. I think that the American people want the war on terrorism to be dealt with. I think that the whole idea of invading Iraq, only if it's a necessity, they want the inspections first. They want us to have our allies supporting this effort, and indeed our allies paying part of the cost of this. I think it's very clear what the American people want. And if our policies were so successful over the last 30 years, then why each succeeding decade do we have more and more terrorism rather than less terrorism? Something is wrong with the fundamental description of the problem we're trying to solve.
Marcy Kaptur, Congresswoman from Ohio's 9th District, thank you very much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
We're at 1-800-423-8255. Al is calling from Toronto, Canada. Hi, Al. You're on the air.
Yeah. Good evening.
Good evening.
My name is Al Mavrook. I am calling from Toronto, Ontario. Originally, I am from the Middle East, but I'm lucky to be in the last 30 years of my life to be in Canada, where he's living peaceful life.
And what's your view of the president's message tonight, Al?
My view is, if any war, any more of these wars, I don't think that will help the interests of the United States in the region. People, before these kind of wars, they were very friendly with any American in the region. Today, American in danger in the area. It's about time that somebody just start any peaceful attitude in the area, not war. War, war.
Al, thanks for calling. Our time is short, but I want to bring Stephen Walt in here, and thank you, Al. Stephen Walt, I hear Marcy Kaptur saying that President Bush isn't on the right track. Richard Pearl very much says he is. I heard your skepticism. The people at the White House have a lot of reports about what's going on in the world. They have access to lots of intelligence. And President Bush surely has a brain trust gathered around him. What makes you how do you read the motivation of this administration if, in your view, they're not on the right track?
I think there's several things there. One is you don't know how much of this is posturing. It's possible that they want to convey the sense that they are ready to go. They're coming after Saddam Hussein. They're going to Baghdad. And this is all a way of trying to sort of increase the leverage, that ultimately they'll be willing to take yes for an answer from the Iraqis. They'll let the UN
and leave Saddam Hussein in place.
Yes. I think there's going to be hard to walk back from that. They've said so much about regime shame over time. But I think that's at least it's possible. You don't know if they're absolutely devoted to it.
Isn't it clear that that pressure has raised the temperature to a point where something much more dramatic is going to happen than would have otherwise?
No, I think there's no question about that. The second thing is you do have within the administration a number of real true believers who have been in favor of regime change in Iraq since even before the Gulf War in 1990-91. And I think they have various reasons, some connected with oil, some connected with seeing Iraq as a threat to Israel. That's part of the motivation there. Within the administration are some of those real true believers. They're taking a very large risk here. We have an economy that's not in particularly good shape. And if this war goes badly, even if we're victorious, but if it goes worse than people imagine, if it does take our eye off the more serious problem of al-Qaeda, if it leads to an American occupation of Iraq that's quite protracted and expensive, then it seems to me it will be seen as a major foreign policy failure. So if the administration continues to push for, you know, imminent military action, I think we ought to understand they are really taking a real risk on this one.
Eric is calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Eric. You're on the air.
Hi.
Good evening.
My first 20 minutes of George Bush's speech tonight was that he didn't believe in anything he was saying.
You didn't find him having the conviction of his own message?
George had no belief. He didn't believe in anything he was saying.
Well, that's a big projection onto the president. How do you read that, Eric?
How do I read that?
How do you see it? What gives you that insight?
He was speech writing. He was reading speeches. He didn't believe in bull in anything he was believing. And my follow-up question is, what are we going to do after we get there? Bomb the hell out of this place and go from there.
Eric, thanks for your call. Stephen Walt, you heard Richard Pearl say earlier, once again, there was a reference to this war as being something that would be very, very quick. Will it be quick? And what about the aftermath?
I think you can imagine scenarios where it might be easy, but we ought to recognize that the Iraqis do have some military options that could make life more difficult for us in it. I think we'd be victorious, but it could be more difficult. The real issue is, what do you do after the regime was deposed? This is a country that has had lots of instability in the past. After the Gulf War, in fact, in 1990-91, when the regime was at least weakened, we saw lots of violence, sectarian violence between different groups within Iraq. There's the potential danger of the Kurdish groups wanting autonomy and that spilling over into both Turkey and Iran. And we don't have any obvious recipe for how you recreate a stable and reasonably effective Iraq. So it's hard to be optimistic that you could go in, tear the regime apart, and not have the responsibility of policing the country for quite some time.
Tim's on the line. Welcome, Tim. You're on the air.
Hey, how you doing?
Real well, thanks.
Good. I'm a registered Democrat, mm-hmm. and I was very skeptical about the president's position and even about a speech tonight. But once I heard a member of my own party, Marcy, a congresswoman from Ohio, and her position, I'm very concerned about my own party's objections to action in Iraq.
And in what respect exactly, Tim?
Pardon me?
In what respect exactly?
Well, there was a lot of denial, mm-hmm. denial of what seemed to be obvious evidence that Iraq is building its arsenal and is refusing to heed U.N. sanctions and U.S. sanctions.
Tim, we're almost out of time. Let me take it right there. Stephen Walt, you look out at the Middle East and the United States as a polity tonight. Do you have any doubt? What are the odds that we are on our way to war?
Well, that's a hard one to call. I think it's still going to be difficult for the administration to go to war if the Iraqis comply to a large extent with a UN Security Council resolution. One of the things that has complicated the administration's campaign is the fact that most of the rest of the world is not with us on this one. It's made it difficult within the Security Council, and it's going to make it difficult to get, I think, popular support at home for a war and international support, despite what the president said about a coalition.
Stephen Walt, thank you so much for being with us tonight. Stephen Walt is academic dean and professor of international affairs at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. You can continue this conversation online. Log on to onpointradio.org and click on forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR Boston.